The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So my name is Andrea, for those of you who have not met before. So many of you may know last Thursday, one of our community members passed away, Victor Medina. I believe Andrea Castillo spoke about it at the end of her talk last week. And yesterday we had had his cremation, and so it's a little up for me, this reflection on death and impermanence, and so I thought I'd explore that with you this evening, this theme of what sometimes are called the heavenly messengers of aging, illness, and death. So the Buddha, I think this reflection on aging, illness, and death was actually central to the Buddha's own path when he was still a prince in the palace. He had some reflections. He's talking in this text about how great his life was. Basically, he said, you know, I had the best life. You know, I had multiple palaces. You know, they had lots of lovely flowers and people to entertain me, and we had the best food, and I had the softest cloth for my clothes, and yeah, life was pretty good. And he said, while I had such power and good fortune, yet I thought, when an untaught ordinary person who is subject to aging, not safe from aging, sees another who is aged, he is shocked, humiliated, and disgusted, for he forgets that he's no exception. But I too am subject to aging, not safe from aging, so it cannot befit me to be shocked, humiliated, and disgusted on seeing another who is aged. So he makes this reflection multiple times on aging, on illness, on death, recollecting that his initial response to seeing those things, you know, when we see somebody who's deformed or, you know, very emaciated with cancer or very old and their body kind of bent out of shape, or a dead being, could be a person, could be an animal. I mean, sometimes we see an animal who's been hit by a car. You know, that experience of seeing an animal hit by a car often there's a revolting of revulsion when we see that kind of thing. You know, we see the exposure of that animal as, you know, body parts and its blood and guts kind of spread on the road. And there's a revulsion to that. And so the Buddha is acknowledging that revulsion, acknowledging that, yeah, this is where I started with this exploration. When I thought about aging, when I thought about illness, I thought about death, I recognized, yeah, not a pretty thing. I feel kind of resistant, revolted by it. And yet, this is my fate. This too is my fate. I too am subject to this condition. Does it befit me to be shocked, disgusted, revolted by something that I am subject to? And he says, when he considered this, the vanity of youth left him, the vanity of health left him, and the vanity of life left him. By vanity there, I think it means, you know, kind of this the vanity of thinking I'm above that somehow, you know. I think that's what he means by that vanity. So it's a kind of an ordinary experience, or perhaps we should say it should be an ordinary experience to see aging, illness, and death. some aspects of our culture hide it away from us. I happened to be, I think it was 47 years old before I saw a dead body. And that was in Burma. I had been managing a retreat in the Sagaing Hills in Burma, and we had been walking down a road, and we saw some commotion. It was a road along a river, and we saw some commotion by the side of the river, and by the time we got there, we saw them carrying a body out of the river, and it was a young boy, probably about 11 or 12, and he had come to the monastery to ordain for a few months and had gone swimming in the river. He was unfamiliar with the currents of the river and had gotten pulled under and had drowned. And so they laid him out on the, there was a kind of a pavilion, and they laid him out at the pavilion. And the whole community gathered around this boy. And there was chanting, there was crying. And it was just such a, it was clear, it was a natural part of life. But it was my first experience of seeing death that close up. It was kind of shocking to me, actually. You know, 47 years old, and I've never seen a dead body. So our aspects of our culture, certain facets of our culture, I think, tend to try to keep us away from these truths, try to keep us away from this fact, these facts of life. And we don't typically consider this kind of, ordinary experience or, it's partly perhaps in our culture because it's kind of pushed aside. We certainly wouldn't consider this kind of exposure to be what would be called a heavenly messenger. And in the time of the Buddha also, this was not so contemplated or reflected on, even in a culture where death, aging, illness were right in the community, just so obvious. There's a story, and this is a kind of a teaching story because it's a story of somebody who's died and gone to the realm of death, and the king of death, King Yama, Yama meaning death, King Yama asks this person, it's kind of like, our Christian culture has the notion of St. Peter at the pearly gates. Well, we have King Yama here questioning the person as he comes to arrive at the kingdom of death. And the king asks him questions. Did you ever see, my good man, the first divine messenger appearing among humankind? And he says, no, I didn't see that. And then King Yama says, but, my good man, didn't you ever see a woman or man aged 80, 90, or 100 years, frail, bent like a roof bracket, crooked, leaning on a stick, shakily going along, ailing, youth and vigor gone, with broken teeth, with gray and scanty hair on their head, wrinkled and blotched limbs? The man replies, yeah, I've seen that. And the king Yama says, didn't it ever occur to you, I too am subject to old age and cannot escape it. Let me do kind acts. Let me take that as, essentially, I think that what he's saying is, let me take that as an inspiration to behave with kindness, behave with compassion, seeing that we are all subject to aging, illness, and death. So this is our experience. We see aging, we see illness, we see death, and we don't take it in as, I too am subject to this. We may know it to some extent, but we don't really take it in. Another teaching story. I love this quote. This is from an old Indian poem called the Mahabharata. And this, the story around this quote is that there was a man who was being questioned by a kind of a divine being. And the question that this divine being asked the man was, "What is the greatest wonder?" And the man thought for a while, and then he responded, "This, I think, is most wonderful, that the man of the world, even though he is seeing before his eyes constantly creatures dying and passing away, never for a moment the idea enters him, I too have to fall. I am also a creature destined to be destroyed. Even if it is told to him, it never enters his mind. Only the surface mind understands the language, but the actual sense never goes into his head. That every man one day must die, yet every man lives as if they were immortal. That is the greatest wonder." So this, I think, speaks to many of our relationships with aging, illness, death. We see it, and yet we don't take in the truth. I too am subject to this condition. Our usual perspective around life, where to find happiness, is in getting what we want, in having things, in having relationships, good job, nice house. So very much our perspective around happiness revolves around acquiring. And this perspective around aging, illness, and death brings in a reflection for us, not only around our own mortality, our own impermanent nature, but that everything in our experience is also impermanent. Cars are subject to aging and death. Don't know about illness. Well, I guess illness, kind of illness. You know, our things will decay. Relationships break up. If they don't break up, one or the other person in a relationship will die before the other. And the Buddha reflected right before he decided to leave home. He was recognizing that he was looking for happiness in perhaps the wrong place. He said, "I'm subject to birth, aging, ailment, death, sorrow. I seek after what is also subject to those things. How can that possibly bring happiness? How can that bring a deeper kind of happiness?" And so he decided to set out looking to answer the question, is there a deeper kind of happiness? He didn't really know the answer, but he knew that deep happiness could not be found in acquiring things that were subject to decay, death. And so he set out to look for another way. You know, our usual perspective of arranging things. There's a beautiful quote, arranging our lives, arranging having things, getting rid of things we don't like. It's a continual process of arranging, trying to figure out, how can I find a way to... I think essentially at some level we do know that things are impermanent, But we still tie ourselves to this belief that having things is where our happiness lies. And we, while we recognize that this thing that I have right now, you know, oh, I've got this new thing, this great new thing, I got this thing, you know, maybe a new iPad. That makes you happy for, you know, a couple months, maybe. Intermittently, maybe, for a couple months. And then after a while, it kind of gets, you know, you get a little bit jaded with the iPad, and it's like, well, it doesn't do everything you want it to do. And so, you know, something else. Maybe there's something else that we can find happiness with. So that thing has kind of faded from its pedestal for us. But we still think there's something out there that will do it for us. And we're continually trying to find that next thing. Continually trying to find that next thing that will somehow make us feel okay. And even if we know to some extent it will only make us feel good for a week or a month or a few days or an hour, a few seconds, we think somehow that our happiness is about arranging our lives such that we have lined up without gaps these experiences that make us feel okay for a short time. And the Buddha, I think, saw, yeah, this may be erroneous. Maybe that's not the way. Maybe there is some other way. Rilke, Rainer Maria Rilke, in his Duino elegies, he has 10 elegies, 10 poems that are really meditations on impermanence and the suffering that comes from the fact of impermanence. And also, I think beautifully at times, the joy that comes with the acceptance of impermanence instead of the resistance of impermanence. In this case, he's talking about this process that we go through, trying to find happiness. He says, "And we, spectators, always, everywhere, turn toward the world of objects. It fills us. We arrange it. It breaks down. We rearrange it, then break down ourselves. Who has twisted us around like this so that no matter what we do, we are in the posture of someone going away? Just as upon the farthest hill, which shows him the whole valley one last time, he turns, stops, lingers. So we live here, forever taking leave." That's kind of the truth of our lives. These reflections on aging, on illness, on death, at first coming from this perspective of resistance, of, you know, revulsion, it's hard for us to take in that these are actually pointing to very deep truths and transformative truths for us. So the reflection on aging, the reflection on illness, the reflection on death doesn't have to be depressing, doesn't have to be morbid. They actually are our teachers, these heavenly messengers, as the Buddhist text puts it. They point to very deep truths about the nature of our experience. Everything, not only our bodies, everything is subject to impermanence. Every experience we have is subject to impermanence. Because every experience we have is subject to impermanence, every object in the world is subject to impermanence. Inherently, those objects, those experiences are unreliable, unsatisfactory as being a source of deep, true, lasting happiness. Their very impermanent nature makes them unreliable. And yet we live our lives trying to find reliability in what is unreliable. So this reflection on aging, on illness, on death, just reflecting, reminding ourselves, the Buddha actually suggested we regularly remind ourselves, I am of the nature to age. I am of the nature to sicken. I am of the nature to die. Just to remind ourselves of that fact can open us to, not to depression, not to morbidity, but actually to an open heart, to compassion. As we see in this reflection of, I am of the nature to age, everything is of the nature to age. I am of the nature to sicken. Everything is of the nature to sicken. All beings are of the nature to sicken. We stop taking it so personally and recognize the poignancy of all of us living this fragile, vulnerable life. And our heart breaks with compassion. Our heart can break with compassion for this vulnerability, this fragility that we're all living in. And we can, of course, resist this truth. When we take this truth in without resistance, it has the capacity to open our hearts. When we take it in or meet it with resistance, our practice then is to open our hearts to resistance, to acknowledge the fear, to acknowledge the confusion, to acknowledge the vulnerability. This begins actually to open our hearts to this truth, meeting the very resistance to it, not trying to push away the resistance, not trying to deny the resistance, not trying to push through the resistance. Sometimes the heart just says, no, it shouldn't be like this. I was teaching a retreat when the many children were massacred in Newtown. And that's what my heart said. Should not be like this. You know, it was, my heart was breaking. And there was a part of my mind that just was not wanting to go there. And yet, you know, I just kept reminding myself in a gentle way, it is like this. It is like this. Sometimes that can help us to hold something very painful. So recollecting on aging, illness, death, the Buddha suggests it has some benefits for us. It helps to put certain things into perspective when we recognize our lives are destined to end. There's a certainty to that truth and an uncertainty as to when. The Buddha says, many do not realize that we here must die. For those who realize this, quarrels end. Don Juan, the teacher of Carlos Castaneda, puts it this way. An immense amount of pettiness is dropped if your death makes a gesture towards you. So reflecting on this, how do we do this? Actually, the Buddha taught contemplations about death in particular. He suggested, first of all, that we just remind ourselves regularly. He said, reflect on this daily. Reflect daily. Just that simplicity of, I'm of the nature to age. I'm of the nature to sicken. I'm of the nature to die. Watch how that informs you. Carlos Castaneda, there's a story, I don't know where this came from, I can't quote the source on this, but there's a story of Carlos Castaneda who was at a dinner gathering at one point, and one woman at the dinner gathering said, I just can't find my way to a spiritual life, something along that lines. And Carlos responded, it's quite simple. Just reflect regularly on the fact that everyone you love and you yourself will die in no particular order at an unknown time. You will soon have a spiritual life. It's a very powerful reflection when we can take it in, when we can allow our hearts to open. How does it land for you? You know, this too. This is my fate. Is there aching in the heart? Is there denial? Is there confusion? Fear? How is it for you? An opening to that. Maybe the ache in the heart, you can just meet that. Maybe the confusion can be met. This isn't about trying to create some other relationship to these reflections, but opening to, you know, the reflective process goes through how we respond. How does it land in us? And what is that? Can we meet that? There's a story in the, kind of a famous story in the texts, the Buddhist texts, of the four heavenly messengers. I've only talked about three so far. Actually, I think the texts really speak of three heavenly messengers, but there is another story. It's often quoted, this story about the four heavenly messengers. The first three being aging, illness, and death. The fourth being the witnessing of someone who can stand in equanimity in the face of those. It's often told as the Buddha's life story. But actually, he tells it kind of as a teaching story of someone who lived long before. And he tells the story about this prince, and it's an interesting name, Prince Vipassi. And I like that because basically the Pali term for what we do here is Vipassana. And so this prince is Vipassi, which basically means clear seeing or seeing things. So the prince has the name of clear seeing. But he goes out with his charioteer, takes him out of the palace, and he sees an old person. And he hasn't seen an old person. Actually, his father, the myth of this goes that his father had a prediction that he would be either a great king or a great renunciate. And his father wanted him to be a great king, so he tried to seclude him in the palace and keep him from seeing anything that might incline him towards going out and becoming a renunciate. And so one day his charioteer, he slips out from the palace with his charioteer, and he sees somebody who's old. And he's never seen anybody old, apparently. And he asks his charioteer, what's that? And his charioteer tells him and says, and we too are subject to that. And he's kind of shocked by that. Then again, he goes through the three. He sees someone who's old, he sees someone who's ill, he sees someone who's dead. The fourth time out, he sees a renunciate. He sees a monk passing through. And he says, "What's that?" Because he sees that there's some kind of bearing or some kind of ease walking in the world that this monastic, this renunciate has. And on seeing that and speaking to the renunciate and understanding something of his demeanor, he decides to leave the palace and become a monastic himself. So it was something about seeing the possibility of calm, of ease, of peace amidst the impermanence of life that was inspiring to this prince. And this is connecting to this fourth messenger, and I think points to how, again, it doesn't have to be depressing, actually. The possibility, this was the inspiration for the prince, that the possibility of this kind of ease in life in the midst of impermanence, the possibility of peace, this seemed worthy of search. This was one of the big lessons I felt I was had the privilege to witness with Victor's death in this last few weeks. I was teaching retreat during the time that he was actively dying, and so I didn't get to spend that much time with him, but I left the retreat one evening a couple of nights before he passed away. And to visit him and his family. And when I walked in to his room, I was really surprised by what I saw. Because Victor, I mean, he was kind of shriveled. He had lost most of his weight. He had very little. I mean, his arms were just like bones. And yet his face was luminous. He gave me the biggest smile and was so present. He was so there. His eyes were so bright that when I just looked into his eyes, it was hard for me to believe that he was dying. He was so present, so much at ease. The morning that he died, his wife tells the story that she asked him in the morning, "Are you in any pain?" And he said, "Oh no, I've made a lot of progress along that line. I'm not in any pain." And again, you know, there were people around, and another person who had spent the night kind of lying on the floor at his bedside. Something woke her up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and she sat up, and Victor was there, and he smiled at her. He said, "I didn't know you were down there." And this was all done in a whisper because his lungs were completely full of fluid. So he could just barely speak. But he gave her a big smile and had, you know, a morning that morning. He was so present, so at ease. He had a morning, he had an egg, he asked Mary for his iPad, and you know, he slipped away in the most common of activities. But he was there. He was right there. It was such an inspiration and such a gift to witness that kind of presence in the face of his own death. To me, this was a heavenly messenger. It was very beautiful, very inspiring to see this. So if we're willing to engage, I think this practice of reflecting on death, being willing to meet with an open heart, can really help us to look at our lives. You know, This reflection on aging, illness, and death can help to align our priorities. You know, how are we spending our time? We do not know. We do not, none of us know when we're going to die. And in that face of that, is it worth looking at how you spend your time? I was reading from my my university sends me, I'm an alumni, and they send me the magazine, you know, every quarter. And I was reading this afternoon, reading through one of the articles about a philosophy teacher at the school that I went to, the University of New Hampshire. And in the middle of this article, he says, there's a quote by this philosophy teacher. He says, "Aliens looking down on Earth would surely see a civilization of screen dwellers. You have X number of hours to live on this planet. What percentage of those hours do you want to spend in front of a screen? When it comes time to die, are you going to think, 'Oh, I should have had more screen time?'" We do spend an inordinate amount of time in front of our devices, you know, looking at that. Another reflection. Everything in everybody, that includes you and me, deteriorates, ages, decays, breaks up, and passes away. And we, living in the forest of desires, are entirely composed of the impermanent. Yet our desire impels us not to see this, though impermanence stares us in the face from every single thing around. And it confronts us when we look within, mind and body arising and passing away. So don't turn on the TV, go to the pictures, read a book, see some food, or 100 other distractions just to avoid seeing this. This is the one thing really worth seeing, for one who fully sees it in himself is free. I'm looking at our actions, our choices in light of this truth. How do we want to spend our time? How do we want to spend our time? So there's still about 15 minutes, and I thought it might be nice to reflect for a few minutes on your own thoughts about your own priorities. You know, how are you spending your time? Just taking, just sitting as you are, but perhaps closing your eyes and just reflecting on how you spend your days. And if you can take in this truth of the fragile, vulnerable state that we're in, are there any changes you might make to choices that you make during your day? It could be really simple. You know, just the, you know, it doesn't have to be anything grand. Like you have to change everything that you're doing, but one reflection I've added through my day is, can I be kinder? How might you go about your day if you had one last day? That kind of reflection can sometimes help to orient us towards what is actually meaningful to us? It's actually important to us? So I'd like to give you all an opportunity to articulate something that you've just explored. So I'd like to suggest that you turn to two or three people nearby you, and then we'll just take 5 minutes. It's going to be really short, just 5 minutes or so, to each person say a few words about what they reflected on. Each person take no more than a minute, and then we'll just come back together into the larger group. Just finding two or three people, groups of three or four. So I'll ring the bell about once a minute so you can keep track of how long the time is. Make sure you give each person a chance to speak. Letting the next person have an opportunity to speak. and wrapping up your conversations. And coming back to the larger group. Is there anything anybody would like to share with the larger group or with me? I didn't get to hear your conversation so much, but anything? Yeah.
I am really struggling with these issues right now. My mother's 94 and she broke her hip 2 weeks ago. And although frail, she's been a very vibrant woman her whole life, very strong, determined, wonderful, you know, all the things. You know, and I do meditate daily about that. I know about the impermanences. I embrace them. We age, you know, we get ill, all that. I am so attached to her.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's the place to see if you can open your heart to so there's a struggle there, right? Because you recognize that she's leaving and you're still holding on. And so can you open your heart to the pain of that holding on? You know, because that is, I mean, it is, it aches. It aches to hold on when something is slipping away. So that's part of our work, you know, to open to that struggle. You know, to not pretend it's not there.
Right.
You know, we can't pretend, you know, if we pretend it's not there, it's denial, you know. So it really, the practice, the meditation is to open to the sadness, the sense of, you know, loss in advance, essentially, you know, that the mind creates that sense of loss in advance. So, you know, letting your heart break and seeing if you can allow that's where I think a lot of the learning, the opening happens, is to see just the allowing the pain of that attachment.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
That reminds me of I brought a poem. I didn't know whether I'd read it or not, but I think I probably have just about enough time to read it. So I'll close with this poem, which to me really speaks to how when we really allow our hearts to break, you know, we open to just a different way of being. So this poem is called Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. Thank you.